guys. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. The website is redice.tv. Well, today we are doing somewhat of a different show here. We used to do a lot of shows on more esoteric and occult subjects, and we're going to return to that here today. But look at this from the other side of the fence, if you will. We're going to speak about the occult roots of the Third Reich and the so-called Germanic occult revival that took place before World War II and then followed on through after that. We're also going to discuss some of the major teachers of this period that lifted out some of the ancient Germanic esoteric thought that ultimately sought to spiritually awaken the Germanic, and I would say in the extension, the European soul. Kalki Weisthor is an Arminist, a Votanist, and a student of the Vedas, a seeker of historical truth, and an advocate of deep ecology. He lives in the southern U.S. He is the proprietor of KalkiWeisthor.net and advocates spiritual awakening of Aryan man as necessary for the survival of our people and of world civilization. He's a former attorney and a former Buddhist whose inspirations include Miguel Serrano and Savitri Devi. Welcome to the show, Kalki Weisthor, a.k.a. Bob Weisthor. It's good to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
I'm glad to be here, Henrik.
Excellent. So tell us, was Kalki Weisthor, what can you tell us about the name first?
Well, I made it up late one night when I was realizing I needed to use an alias for something, and it's sort of the first thing that came to me. In retrospect, it's not too bad. It comes from two separate sources that were influences for me in my sort of spiritual development, if you want to call it that. One, of course, the first name being Kalki, which is the 10th avatar of Vishnu from Hinduism and from the Vedic systems, he's the avatar that comes at the end of the Kali Yuga to bring an end to the degradation of the Kali Yuga and to clean things out to bring in the new Golden Age, the new Satya Yuga. And I think I was probably influenced to use that from reading Savitri Devi. She talks about Kalki a lot, and people talk about, you know, the esoteric Hitlerists talk about Hitler as the avatar of Kalki. Anyway, and there was actually a Gore Vidal novel called Kalki, which was sort of interesting that I'd read as a very young man, which was, of course, it was Gore Vidal, but it was interesting. Weisthor is one of the pen names of Karl Maria Villiget, who was it was known as Himmler's Rasputin. He was sort of an old man at the time of the early NSDAP era, pre-war era, who was introduced to Himmler, had a lot of influence on the esotericism, such as it was of the SS. And he designed the SS Totenkopf ring. He had a lot to do with design of Bevelsberg Castle. And there's a lot more about him, but basically it was those two guys, one of who was an avatar of Vishnu and the other who was a sort of one of the more out there modern German occultists. And sort of reflecting the fact that a lot of my own personal spiritual development came through Eastern systems and then also through the Germanic system later on.
So our topic today is not one that, you know, we are accustomed to here on the show, but it might be, I don't know, it might be a mouthful for some newcomers to swallow, but I wanted to go into some of this as a way to understand, you know, the underpinnings of what helped partially the rise of National Socialism in Germany. You know, I saw the documentary many years ago. It was my favorite for many years, actually, called The Occult History of the Third Reich. They detailed this from a very negative point of view. This was something wacky and quirky, and these people were kind of insane. I think that's what they're more or less trying to convey, but I always find it really, really interesting, and I hope to kind of get closer to some of that and some of the valid thoughts, if you will, within that from the point of view of esotericism. But tell us first, Bob, when did you first become interested in the history of the Third Reich?
That probably started, it's hard to say specifically, of course, at a very young age. My mother was of a German background. She was actually raised by Pennsylvania Dutch, and my parents were the World War II generation. And so I had this sort of dormant interest in Germany. And I think when I was in junior high, I was sort of one of these misfit geeky kids. We were sort of like the kids in Stranger Things without the computers. You know, this is probably the 1960s. And my best friend was this genius kid who was multilingual at age 12 or whatever. And he seriously got into, I think, early Soviet Russian history. He became an early Marxist. He was just a huge fan of Lenin and all that really real severity. And I don't know how much of that he kept as he got older. It's impossible to say. But it sort of as a parallel or competition, I said, well, what else can I find that's different that I can sort of make mine? And I pulled off, you know, and what I had was probably propagandistic crap. I probably had the Shirer book on the Third Reich or something, you know, The Rise and Fall, the William Shirer book, which is extremely anti-German. But at the time, none of that really rubbed off on me. It's something else that seems sort of mean and extreme and cool, you know, like the other side of the Russians. So I got into it then. And so I read a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I read that and I read Mein Kampf, and I was probably ages 13 or something, you know. And I think it went dormant in my psyche. And then years later, when I had come back to an interest in Germanic lore, I think through Ossetru probably, you know, many, many years later, probably within the last 15 years from now, it sort of came together for me.
Well, what do you think about, you know, we talk a lot about that on this program, the version that we're getting of Germany, this kind of cartoonish version, obviously of Hitler too and all these things. And you know, despite the fact of what people might think they know, I think very few actually have looked into what the real material is about and what it offers. You know, this, it's always a very difficult subject to approach, let's be honest, because we're working up against layers and decades of just misinformation, propaganda, and all these kinds of things. So a big part of this is obviously revisionism, right? To look at all of this history again and try to get a more accurate kind of version of history. What would you say to newcomers to a subject like this? Is there anything that people should know about of why they should take this, you know, topic seriously and not just throw it out with the rest of the propaganda version that they've been given?
Well, as to why, I would say that certainly it becomes apparent if you study recent history. I think the biggest tell in modern times is probably the extreme oversensitivity we still have to what happened during World War II. You know, on a daily basis, we're still being told, reminded of the Holocaust. We're being reminded of somehow how Hitler was Satan. And, you know, all this stuff. And it's bizarre if you think about it, because even by the standards, even if the Germans had done everything that they were accused of, they still don't come up to the cumulative total of sheer evil and inhumanity that, say, Stalin had, even by the numbers of popular history.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a small fraction of people affected compared to the Soviet era, but people don't walk around calling, no one's calling Donald Trump Stalin. You know, it's not a symbol. Or anything else, any other period of history, you know, Genghis Khan, you know, certainly Napoleon did a lot of damage, but he's almost admired, you know, which is maybe okay. But so obviously there's something very sensitive that's still affecting us on a daily basis. And I think if you start to look at this stuff, you realize that there was a watershed moment then in the 20th century, in the middle, early part of the century, when things could have been different, but they weren't. It's like the tide rolled up and rolled back, and we're still living in the aftermath of that. And so you have to really try to look at, maybe try to find out what really happened, but you can't. As to how, you almost have to stumble into it, because almost every source you can find is propaganda, and you have to learn to read the anti-German propaganda for the truth that's in it and try to construct an alternative narrative. I think that the first book, when I started waking up that things might not be as they were told to me, was probably, of all things, a book that Pat Buchanan wrote called The Unnecessary War.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's not all the way awake book, but it's helpful. It certainly just tells you some more truth about, say, Churchill, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's a good intermediate step. And, the person that really I trust most with regard to the history probably is David Irving.
And it's funny because that new movie is coming out, Denial. I don't know if you saw any of the trailers or anything.
No, I've avoided them studios.
It's a new coming out, obviously slandering David Irving while lifting up Deborah Lipstadt in a good light. Hilarious.
Right. And if you talk to, you know, I've met David Irving, I think, three times in small groups and spoken to him and sort of gotten what he says to people on most of these issues. And he never, you know, he always kind of avoided the Holocaust topic, and he, you know, he'll say he had a turning point early in his career, and if he had to do over again, he's not sure that he would say everything that he said. He might have played it safe and kept himself as a safe, accepted, you know, popular historian, and not had his life ruined by the people that basically destroyed his life, had him banned from countries, and made his books extremely hard to find.
Yep. Book burners. Yep.
Yeah, you know, it's his methods of history is almost unique. He has a very everything that you read in his books, and he's not a professional historian in the normal sense. He goes into things. All of his sources are mostly primary textual sources or interviews. He doesn't read other writers on the topic. He refuses to. He says repeatedly that he's never read Mein Kampf all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because he considers it to be co-written by some other people. So in a way it makes his books a little literal-minded. He doesn't expand on things. So you have to read. If you want to learn facts, that's the place to go, is to read his stuff. And what he says about, for example, you know, he's kind of had been attacked by people on the right recently for supposedly for reversing himself and saying, yes, there was a Holocaust. And I never knew him to be a Holocaust denier. He avoided the topic, but he seemed to have always had an impression that some bad things happened, especially at the end of the war in Germany. He was known for a fairly unique position of saying they weren't really Hitler's fault. They were people that were working around him and doing things. And he makes a pretty good case for some of that.
Right. What was it? Operation Reinhard, was it, or something? Right. It was a couple of other things going on behind the scenes, which wasn't known to Hitler. I guess that's his take.
Yeah, and you can ask David Irving, the last time I saw him, people saying he didn't know, and he said, well, yeah, he knew. But I think the answer is he knew and kind of didn't want to know. That's certainly not where Hitler wanted to put his energy. He's very well known to have been against things like, you know, Kristallnacht, for example, which he thought was just had horrendous consequences. And David Irving also says Hitler was kind of an anti-Nazi in a lot of ways, because he kind of used the Nazi system to come to power to further his German nationalism, and then tried really to spend a lot of his time, especially during the war, trying to keep away from some of these people, to keep their goals away from them. And they were in, for example, the whole anti-Jewish thing that started supposedly, say, in the last 2 or 3 years of the war. He was known for repeatedly saying, let's resolve that after we win the war. But it's hard to say. I think there were things that were going on that were kind of became necessary in wartime that nobody would want. I think that, you know, certainly that at some point they started moving things, people out and shipping Jews off to the east without having anywhere to put them. And you have documents with Hans Frank and those people in Poland saying, okay, what are we supposed to do to these people? You know, what do we do with this? You're busing this train loads of people. What do we do with them? And there was no answer. So what did they do? They probably killed them. You know, I don't know the answer is you're not going to find the answer in the mainstream. You know, we could talk all day about where the 6 million number comes from. And it's certainly an occult symbol of some sort.
Right.
Probably to do with the tree of life. So, but then again, you know, there were people who call themselves revisionists and say, oh, no, they were nice. Germans were nice to the Jews. None of that happened. And that's just, you know, probably not the truth. So, the thing is, we need to, at some point, look and see what really happened and realize that that was actually a very minor part of what was happening in World War II. It's a distraction. It's to draw our attention away from what Roosevelt and Churchill said quite clearly in their private conversations and papers was, that it wasn't a war against Nazism, it wasn't a war against Hitler, it was a war to destroy Germany.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, you can look, and I've read, you know, you had Germar Rudolph on a few weeks ago, and I read one of his books, which is extremely technical, and beyond me technically, but very convincing. You know, you have Fred Leuchter's stuff, then you have a bunch of secondary writers who are really just writing, you know, the flip side of what the main writers are, you know, who are just regurgitating facts. But I trust Irving's work on this. And I think the answer is we don't know what happened, and we can't know until we get the lies out of the way.
Well, exactly. This is it, though. There's so much propaganda and layers of other intentions to push things this way or that direction. So, yeah, for genuine, open, just inquisitive truth seekers, it's probably one of the more difficult subjects there is to try to wrap your head around. But this is obviously the physical history right here. And what we want to do today is actually talk more about the metaphysical aspects, not only behind National Socialism itself, but some of the things that kind of helped to initiate this movement, some of the things that were lying beneath all of this, the the undercurrents. So when did you start getting an interest for that side of things, the occult or kind of the esoteric Germanic traditions?
Well, I think I always had an interest in the occult. I was a philosophy major as an undergrad. I'd always had a spiritual interest. And I sort of, in terms of Western philosophy, I mean, I was born, my parents were not Christian per se. They took me to church. I remember a few times thinking, you know, kids should go to church. This was the South in the 60s, you know, and so it seemed obligatory. And I just remember thinking, this is crap. I don't believe a word of this stuff, you know. So, like, I never had an indoctrination in Christianity. And I looked at all sorts of options, but I never really was exposed to the Germanic stuff until the 21st century. I had given up on the Western traditions. I studied philosophy up till about the 20th century and decided that it disappeared in Western society and really had directed my attention toward Eastern philosophy and practices. And for most of my life, off and on since about 1980, when I was, say, 21 or 20 or somewhere in there, early 20s, I was Buddhist for many years of various denominations, concentrating on Zen. I studied Hinduism a lot, and I had gone off in those directions and hadn't really studied, you know, I mean, I didn't know. I read Thor comic books as a kid, you know, that was about it. I hadn't really taken any of that seriously any more than I had any other myths. And I think it was probably sometime around between 2006 and 2007 or 8. I've been doing a lot and really involved with the Zen meditation group. And we were doing, obviously, a long periods of meditation. And I don't claim the meditation experience some people have. They go, you know, people go 12 hours a day of meditation for months. It's just, I could never do that. I never had the patience for it. You know, I would do these things. You would sit for 12 to 14 hours for 2 or 3 days. And we were sitting regularly, you know, sometimes for a few hours a day. And there is a certain thing that happens in meditation, and I won't go into too much detail, but really all the forms wind up being the same. If you sit there long enough doing meditation, whatever practice you're doing will eventually drop away and you're just sitting there. You get tired of doing whatever it is they told you to do to distract your mind when you started meditating. And what the Buddhists and a lot of the Eastern teachers and students want you to see is nothingness, you know, your personality being like an onion, it disappears and drops away, and you see nothing. And I think that's true for some people. That's what's there. And that has to do with the eternal return and what Serrano talks about is the materiality of some people's existence. But for me, I saw something. Something started coming up, and it was me, and I recognized it, and it led me into saying, well, who am I? Who are my roots? Who are my people? Who am I connected with on a before human, you know, before this human birth sort of level? And it led me to Ossetru, and I got lucky. I found an Ossetru kindred in the area where I lived. I got involved with the Ossetru Folk Assembly early. I started reading Stephen Flowers, Edred Thorson's rune stuff, all of which I think is a very valid path to go down. I wasn't sidetracked by any of the universal Ossetru or any of the stuff that's out there, which is basically disinformation. And that led me ultimately, I think Edred Thorson led me back to the, you know, he's the one that certainly is responsible for us having available a lot of the works of, say, Guido von List and Villiget. And I was involved with the Rune Guild for a while also. So I think that's what led me to it, and then I sort of started pursuing. Then once I read Savitri Devi, who he doesn't talk about, I don't know how I found her. You know, I think I had my real awakening to the depth of some of this stuff one night, and I was sitting around. I think that was when I still used to drink, and I was probably sitting around drinking, watching videos on my computer, and I saw the Swedish singer Saga sing her version of "Ode to a Dying People," and I remember it just hit me, and it just hit me, and I was in tears, and I listened to this about 20 times, and I still felt that the next day, and I pursued that, and it leads to a kind of a gut level, that was an emotional response, obviously, but I think it leads to a deeper level commitment to this sort of thing, and then I started reading Guido von List and some of these people, and it goes from there.
Interesting, yeah, because, you know, that's an important aspect of, you know, something that reaches through through time, basically, which is also deeper beyond than just obviously the National Socialists and what that movement was about. This is much more than that. This is something that goes way, 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 way back into history. And obviously pre-National Socialism in Germany, there was a revival of this, right? Some of these traditions started coming back. There's probably many, many different reasons for this, and we can get into that later. You know, the onset of modernity itself, industrialization, a disconnection, a loss to a certain extent of Christianity, and a people overall that's trying to find some kind of root point in existence, right, of being critical of modernity itself, but also trying to kind of justify, you know, what all of this is about. So there's a very fascinating tradition here, which I think, you know, wherever your stance is on National Socialism today, try to kind of just get that out of the way for now and listen to what that pre-period tells you and what these teachers tell you. And we'll get into that more in detail. But how would you describe, you know, German occult revival to someone who's new to it? What are some of the tenets of this?
Well, it's hard to say what the tenets are because everybody changed it. You know, it's when you talk about a German occult revival, you have to think revival of what? And that's really the hard question to answer, because if you try to look at German occultism before this period, you don't find much that was specifically German. And I think the reason that it came up, a lot of it, you know, a lot of the stuff we're talking about, especially the film that you talked about, The Occult Roots of Nazism, it's based on the Nicholas Goodrich Clark book, The Occult Roots of Nazism.
Mm-hmm, right.
He wrote one called Black Sun, which is sort of the follow-up into post-war times. And, you know, most of these writers will attribute the occult revival to, as you said, sociological factors. I think those are factors. There's no doubt. You had a united Germany for the first time starting in 1871 ever. And you can't ignore the fact that a lot of these writers were Austrians. A lot of these mystics were Austrians. And they were people who were, you know, here's a German nation for the first time, and you have the second largest area in Germany, which is suddenly excluded from Germany. And there's a huge, you know, pan-German movement that wanted to get back to Germany. So there are big sociological factors. But I think what you really have is people touching base with a tradition that had come from, now you can look at the Knights Templar, the Order of Teutonic Knights. You can go back into the Parsifal story. Certainly you had Wagner, you know, popping up about this time. You had Nietzsche. You had a certain, as Carl Jung, who probably describes all this as well as anybody, though he wasn't part of the revival because he was much more mainstream, he describes it as the re-arising of the Votan archetype. And, you know, his essay Votan, which was in 1936, probably described it about as well as anything. Serrano talks a lot about Jung in his books. And Miguel Serrano, who maybe we'll discuss later, one of his most popular books has to do with his friendship starting in the early 50s with Carl Jung and with Hermann Hesse. And his take on Jung is that Jung understood everything, all the metaphysics of the re-arising of the German people and all that, but didn't express it because as a person, he always had ambitions to be popular and mainstream to a certain extent. And it was kind of a failing of his personally. He became very anti-German after World War II, or at least moderately so. And just to get along, I imagine, to survive and not be swept up in the backlash. To get into it too much, yeah, you know, what we're looking at a revival of is probably what was the native European psyche before the invasion of the Semitic religions. You know, what I call the religions of the demon from the desert that came in with Christianity and Judaism and Islam, and which was submerged and, of course, came up through the cover of Christianity all throughout recorded history, you know, since the first millennium. So I think what we're looking at is revival of something that's older than we know. It certainly, you know, I'm a big fan of, say, Ball Tielak's book, The Archicoma of the Vedas, which tries to taste, you know, the oldest Indo-European stories go back to probably at least about the end of the last ice age, you know, back to between 12 and 10,000 years ago. And the question is, who were those people and where did that take place? that's the spirit of the people, I think, of the West. That's our people, and it's been covered up and submerged. And I think this started reemerging in these teachers starting in about 1880s, probably.
You know, I find it interesting that the entire tradition of all of this, you know, that our ancestors, you know, the Germanic, the Nordic, Anglos, I mean, in the extension, the whole European family, that this tradition that we were into have been tainted by, you know, so-called Nazism, right? That it's, and I'm talking about the kind of Nazism as it's conceptualized to us today in the modern age. But all of that pre-Nazi, esoteric, Germanic tradition, nature connection, all of those things have basically been ruined, right, because of the rise of Nazism. They managed to basically take our connection to all of this and make it a no-go zone for us, which I think, and we can get into this in more detail later, but I think it has made us a very, I don't know how to put it, weak and vulnerable people, to be honest, because that connection has almost now forever been severed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly what happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s with the Nazi arrival is only one of many different things that could have come out of this reawakening of Germanic consciousness. It certainly wasn't necessary, and it was really kind of made to happen by pressures from the other side. It's unfortunate that it gets pinpointed and spotlighted as with this one symbol of an era that failed, yeah. I think there are other ways. You know, you certainly could ignore that whole era, look at only the preceding teachings, and take them forward into modern times, which is a lot of people have tried to do, even starting with you know, the Runic revival post-war probably started with this guy named Carl Spiesberger. Then you have Thorsen stuff. You have groups like the AFA, which are Volkish and which are go to Germanic roots, but certainly aren't Nazi organizations.
Right.
And don't affiliate with them in any way. But yeah, it's unfortunate all this happened. It's interesting to see exactly what did happen there. But and one thing that the Goodrich Clark book does a good job of is debunking a lot of the sort of Nazi occult stuff that did arise, say, starting in the 60s. You know, have Mourning of the Magicians, and you have these other books that are sort of fantasy, saying that, you know, Hitler was some sort of black magician or something, you know, and he certainly was not. I mean, he didn't operate. As a matter of fact, you know, the National Socialists banned all these organizations, even some of the organizations like the Thule or the Thule Society that can be seen as one of their immediate predecessors, because they didn't want that to be a distraction. So you could say a lot of these people, you know, these Kummer and Marby, who were two of von Liszt's followers, disciples, including, I think it was Marby that came up with the runic yoga stuff, which has to be the silliest offshoot of the whole runic revival.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
These people wound up in camps, you know.
Right.
They were not as popular because simply, and actually, you know, Weisthor himself, Carl Maria Villiget, was, you know, once his stuff came too far out and opened some of his claims, you know, he was actually cut off in about 1938 and was never a part of the Annenerbe, which was the National Socialist Historical Investigation Society, and was kind of, all these people were shunted to the side. So you could say that, you know, the Nazis deserted these people and went for a version and went off in a different direction. Now, that's not necessarily the only argument, but it is an argument.
Interesting. All right. Well, lots to discuss there, but let's just kind of talk a bit about some of the teachers you wrote about. You wrote a good piece detailing four of these, and we can, I'll leave this up to you, Bob. I mean, we can either go through them one by one, and you can give us an overview, or we can just kind of, you know, dive into all of them at once, or however you want to do this. But we have four to discuss a little bit more in detail. It's Guido von Liszt, Carl Maria Villiget, Savitri Devi, and Miguel Serrano. You mentioned all of them so far, but what should we know about them?
Well, now two of these, you know, von Liszt was probably the guy who is most responsible for starting this German occult revival, and was really the only one. You know, he died in 1919, so he was all over with before there even was a National Socialist Party. He had people that followed him. One of his younger contemporaries was Jörg Lanz, known as Lanz von Liebenfels, who survived into I don't know how long he lived, actually. He was still writing. That's the only evidence we know of Adolf Hitler's connection with any of these people is that Hitler at least pretty convincingly read Ostara, which was Luntz's publication. We know that. There's an apocryphal story that he may have met Luntz once, and Luntz took pity on him because he looked forward and gave him a bunch of free editions of Ostara. You know, that's one of the stories. But these are the pre-war stuff. If you look at the next one I mentioned, Villiget, he was an older guy. He was probably 70 by the time World War II started. And he claimed some really wacky things in terms of contemporary psychology. He claimed he was part of a lineage that went back 280,000 years.
Right.
And, you know, so he's interesting, certainly because he was so extreme. The other two that I talked about, Savitri Devi and Miguel Serrano, even though they were around during World War II, they certainly weren't in Germany and had no influence until after. So, you know, probably to start with von Liszt would be the most valid way to talk about, you know, what influences they may have had on the era.
Let's do that.
Guido von Liszt is interesting. He's sort of he was born, I think, in 1848. He was Austrian. And the most interesting sort of telling apocryphal, no, I think it's pretty verified story of him as a youth, as a boy of, I think, I figured out he must have been 13 or 14. He goes with his father into the catacombs beneath St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, and out of nowhere announces that when he's older, he will come back and one day and build a temple to Wotan in that space, which is odd. I mean, this is for a 14-year-old kid. I mean, they knew that he would have been capable of having access, say, to the Eddas at this point, some early stuff. But he obviously was having his own experiences. And for most of his life, he was a literary figure, and probably, and even though he sort of had attachments to all this ancient German lore, but that's not what he was. I mean, he wrote some fiction based on that, but he was basically just a literary writer. And then I believe it was in 1892, he had cataract surgery and went blind for a year. And during that time, generated out of his own little darkness there, his own nine nights hanging from Irminsul, generate his own armonic, runic system, which is not historically based. It was something he came back with. It used some known runes and put them together in different ways, and was sort of his own Gnostic experience brought up, you know, from these depths. And so originated systems of teaching, you know, he called it Arminism. The term Ariosophy has been applied to him. But really, Ariosophy goes with a much more Christian-oriented system that came with Luntz, I think. And, you know, he basically said that the early religion of the people was Wotan. And a lot of his teachings were based on his runic system. And I won't go into details on that. You can read Thorsten Siebenflower's book, The Secret of the Runes, I think it's called, about him. But there was a Guido von Liszt Society, which may, for all I know, still be around. He had an inner, more esoteric circle called the HAO, I think it's the Hohe Armenen Orden, which was more private teaching. So he really founded a full-blown esoteric society in his older age. And again, died in 1919 after predicting that the Germans would win the war and usher in a new golden age. So he obviously lost a little credibility at that point after the war.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly led to all these other teachers even being in existence. And again, Luntz, I really hate to not mention him, even though I didn't write about him because I really don't find him anywhere near as compelling. He was a Cistercian monk, and his writing is much more racialist, say, than von Liszt. Von Liszt wrote about the Aryans as sort of from a positive sense of being the people that, you know, his history and all this esoteric higher meaning came from. Luntz was very, you know, he writes about the decline of humanity through the interbreeding of Aryans and pygmies. You know, he has this thing called theozoology.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it capitulates a lot of, you know, we don't want to leave out theosophy in discussing these people because,
right.
You know, you have Madame Blavatsky, who is a Russian mystic who was around before Guido von Liszt, even though I think the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875, I think. And I think there, the German one was founded, guy's name starts with an H, that I can't remember his name, that started it, was in the 1880s. And so they were around before von Liszt, and certainly after he brought his experiences up into the light, after he got his eyesight back again, he relied on a lot of theosophy to sort of structure his system. And, you know, what you have there is in Blavatsky, and theosophy also over time changed a lot, was used, and there's still theosophy around now because it's a very sort of multiculturally acceptable system. Blavatsky talks about root races, but, you know, and we are, the root race of the current world would be the Aryan race, but it's not about one specific group of people within that. You know, it's more about, it's something accessible to everybody. But I think the real interesting thing about Blavatsky, if you look at these system of root races that she came up with, the first race was, who were an Arctic race, I believe, were really non-material in the normal sense. She talks about, as these root races come about, and I think we're the fifth of seven, the universe itself goes from being spiritual to material. It shifts downward towards the material. So that the first root race was not really physical in the way we are. And she goes through Atlanteans and Lemurians, and the Lemurians are kind of the equivalent in her system of what Lance was talking about, supposedly they bred themselves out of existence by breeding with animals or something, you know. It's all very strange. But you can look at theosophy as a structure behind all these people, and I think there's a lot to it. Anyway, we get through these guys. You have a bunch of offshoots of von Liszt and up to the First World War. There's a period in which nothing happens. Now, if you want to talk about Villiget, he was a World War I soldier. He was career military, probably always a little strange. As a matter of fact, one of the things that brought him down was, it was discovered after he was affiliated with Himmler's group that he had his wife had had him committed for a while when he was younger. She thought he was too out there, spent too much time in his occult studies. And the Nazi Party was very much the same reason they got rid of a lot of their officers, by accusing them of homosexuality or something, or, you know, or being remarried or some other horrible scandal, you know, that would come up with them.
Right.
They're very sensitive to these kind of social pressures, being good, proper Germans. But he came out with some writings and teachings. He said that he was the last of a long line, a family-based line of mystics. And he structured history as a war between Wotanists and Harmonic Christians. And Lance had also talked about Harmonic Christianity, which historically has some validity, especially if you want to look at, say, the teachings of the Gnostics. You know, the teaching of a reborn God did not originate with Judeo-Christianity. But he is very much an anti-Wotanist. He said the Wotanists were the evil ones that had combated the Christians with a K. So his system was very odd. He's really known, and he came out with, he has very few writings, most of which are in no known language. It's something that looks like a Proto-Indo-European or some old German, really can't be translated. If you read a book by Stephen Flowers called The Secret King, he talks a lot about Villiget and actually includes as an appendix a lot of his writings. And there was something called the Halgarita charms that apparently it was like the Vedas. It was some huge body of teachings that he would only able to recall and get written down a small portion in his lifetime. And it's very interesting. The first time I read that book, I decided for some reason, since they were, you know, since you can't read them to have meaning, the words don't mean anything in any modern language, I read them by calling out the words as I read them. So I read them aloud, basically, the way they would have been read in pre-literate times, like the Vedas were. And they had a very powerful sort of mystical presence to them. So it's interesting stuff. But that's all he really left behind. There's no books. He designed, again, you know, this officer's ring that the SS had, was probably responsible for a lot of the design of Bevelsburg. But it was mostly just kind of an aberration. I include him because you know, my main thesis in this was that these people all went down, and as Votan did by hanging on the tree, the world tree, looked down, gathered up the runes, and as the saying goes, fell back again. In other words, they brought this thing up from the well. They expressed it in terms of their own personalities and their own needs and their own people, their own collective, their own psyche and the collective psyche of their group, and gave us different systems, which is what I think each of us has to do to get meaning out of all this stuff. Ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you can't, you know, any of these teachings can result in a religion, and people do need religion. And, you know, most people don't have the capacity to do this stuff, honestly. So I think people need religions to have rules to live by. But
yeah, I mean, this is very detailed. It's very, it can be difficult to kind of sort out some of the nuances. And as far as we know, some of them, or much of the material perhaps even, isn't really, I mean, I know it's based on you know, traditions. It comes from somewhere. It comes from a kind of a Germanic psyche, if you will. But some of it seems that a lot of the people that are involved in it are such mystics, if you will, that they kind of pull this out of the abyss to a certain extent. It isn't like, you know, kind of based on something, because, I mean, we have some texts and stuff like that. We have sagas, you know, and Germanic traditions. But I don't know how accessible much of that work were in those times when they were alive, you know?
They had the Eddas, you know, in some translation, in some version. They certainly didn't have a lot of the more recent archaeologically available stuff, and you know about that. But I think, but you have to look at the fact that, you know, our best known sources of Votanist or any of these old Nordic or Germanic sources are come through, say, Snorri, the Christian priest, for example.
Right.
Who writes stories about the Norse gods like they were the Greek gods, like they were entertainment for stories. And he had his own, he was very much a politician too, so he had his own motives. Even though he obviously liked this stuff, he wasn't hostile to it, but it's kind of, you know, it's a horrible, I can't think of the right analogy offhand, but, you know, he's certainly not the source you want for this. And it really, I think the stuff is lost. I think a lot of it survives in the Vedas, you know, in the parallel teachings of the Iranian people like the Avesta. And in the Vedas, in the Indian teachings, in the Hindi.
Yeah, see, that's interesting. I want to talk a bit more about that later, maybe if we have time, on the Eastern connection to much of this too, and kind of how that comes to us. But what else should we know about Villigut before we move on to Savitri Devi?
Not much. That's about much him. It's enough about him, really. He's interesting, but probably not all that, didn't have that much influence. Just interesting. And Savitri Devi, I think, on the other hand, is someone that is somebody we should all read. I mean, her magnum opus is The Lightning and the Sun, but some of her other books are almost more instructive. Savitri Devi was a woman who was, I think she was born in 1905. And she was in France. Her father was a Greek who had French citizenship. Her mother was English. She was very much a polylingual, you know, certainly a genius. She had two graduate degrees, I think one in math and one in, I can't remember, philosophy or some more, you know, or some more aesthetic subject. But she, reasons of her own, unfortunately, unlike Villigut and von Liszt, I can't point to any kind of mystical experience in her early life that she had. And she's the one of this group who is certainly not an occultist. In any sense, she certainly didn't bring forth any kind of esoteric system. She, on the other hand, she started as a Greek nationalist, and over the course of the time was disappointed with that. So by the time we get to the pre-war years, she had become a big fan, certainly of the National Socialists in the modern world, but probably even prior to that had decided the only surviving Indo-European story was the closest thing we had to modern Indo-European teachings or Aryan teachings was in Hinduism, was the Vedas. So she actually moved to India and again became very political in India. One of the first things she wrote was, I can't remember, something about the Hindus, you know, which was trying to get the Hindus geared up to promote and save their religion, both from Christianity and from Islam. And she was doing this in India. Wound up as World War II was coming on, she married a like-minded Indian, and it was probably just a marriage of convenience between the two of them, who was also very pro-National Socialist, named Mukherjee. who's a publisher in India. And all of her stuff, and all through the war, wrote these tracts that are based on, you know, the Vedic. She was the first person that came up with the idea that Hitler was an avatar of Vishnu for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In modern times. She was very much into parallel movements that had gone on in Germany. You know, we didn't mention these social movements that were going on before any of this that were parallel. Like, for example, the whole Lebensreform movement in Germany and the Wanderfugel, who were basically like, you know, back to naturist hippies in pre-World War I Germany.
Right, yeah.
World War I Germany. And they're very interesting, the Wanderfugel, because they were sort of hippies, you know, pacifists for the most part. You know, they weren't certainly weren't a warlike tribal people. But they became the soldiers of World War I, and they became the Stahlhelm. You can see them transformed, you know, at the earlier part of the 20th century. But she was very much into animal rights. She was a vegetarian, vegan, I think. I'm not sure she was vegetarian. I don't know how she felt about milk. And most of her writing in India was only available in Indian publication. After World War II was over, when it was safe to go back to Germany, she went into Germany and was doing what she considered to be, you know, pilgrimage trips, basically. And on her, I believe that was her second trip back, she actually managed to, she printed off a whole bunch of Nazi revival pamphlets and took them back into Germany in like 1948, which was, you can imagine how well that went over.
Right, yeah.
She got herself arrested and thrown into jail. And one of her more interesting writings to me is a book called Gold in the Furnace, which is about her experiences as a prisoner in Germany. You know, I kind of read through the lines in Savitri Devi, and actually I think they treated her as a curiosity. She certainly wasn't abused as a prisoner. You know, I think she sort of got special treatment. Here's this weird little crazy woman from, you know, a European woman who's been living in India who thinks Hitler was a god. What should we do with her? I put her in prison, you know.
Right.
I'm not sure if she realized how she was being taken by these people, but post-war she became big in the what was known as the neo-Nazi revival starting in the 60s and did a lot of touring and circuitry. Her main book was something called The Lightning in the Sun, which she sets up. Not only does she use the system of the four yugas from Hinduism and the Kali Yuga, the final yuga we're in, which is ended by the appearance of Hitler as the avatar of Vishnu to lead into the new golden age. And of course, you know, that didn't happen, and she knew that already at that time. So Hitler is not the last, but he's the precursor for the last. And she said it was because he was too nice. He wasn't hard enough to be the final avatar. And she has her own theories of men in time, men above time, and men against time. Men in time are people who are helping to bring the destruction about as quickly as possible. She uses Genghis Khan as her example. Men above time are just people too holy to get involved in the whole process. She uses the pharaoh Akhenaten as probably the first monotheist, who was, I think, the father of King Tut.
Yep.
And then talk about men against time. I think she uses Hitler as the prime illustration, which is kind of an, you know, her view of history, and I won't get into it too much because it's interesting that she's that. You know, this kind of historical determinism is almost Hegelian or Marxist, which is odd considering the rest of her philosophy.
Right.
And I think it leads us to the kind of the false conclusion people have that things are inevitable, that are governed by fate, which I think we need to escape from before. You know, I think we need to talk about that at some point.
Yeah, definitely.
None of this was preordained. We still have options. And then, to wrap this up, Miguel Serrano, who is probably the most complete, and really, in a lot of ways, the most interesting of all these systems, was a Chilean diplomat, among other things, who was originally a National Socialist. I believe Serrano was born in 1917, was radicalized by the killings by National Socialists in Chile in, I think, 1938 of a bunch of Chilean National Socialists. By they shut them up in a room and murdered them. He became committed to the National Socialist cause. And after the war, in about 1951, I think, was further radicalized and became openly Nazi, which is a little late. But he has the most complete, full-blown, what I would call an esoteric system. There are still Serranoists. He coined the word esoteric Hitlerism and said that Savitri Devi was the founder of it. But his system was much more full-blown esoteric than she ever became. And he goes back into very sort of, you know, his theories of the origin of existence in time remind me more than anything else of J.R.R. Tolkien's stuff from the Silmarillion. And it's very Gnostic, but on the other hand, he was very tantric. He actually had a spiritual or mystic teacher who is a German who had come to Chile. And his name is known, but I can't remember it. It was a Spanish name, and I have serious problems with him. And so he was considered himself to be part of an esoteric school. There are esoteric, Serranoist esoteric Hitlerists out there now. I'm in touch with some of them. I'm not sure I'm not going to use anybody's name or group names because I'm not sure how public they want to be. Who are, but you know, it's a very esoteric thing. It's not political in the modern age. It's very much about, he's very Gnostic. If you know, if people read the Gnostics, they'll understand a lot of people coming into that you're a pre-existing spiritual entity that comes into the modern world and there is able to perfect its individualism through having a material body to, and then to preserve itself as an eternal self. It's like you become a soul, a complete soul in the material world, and it's used for that purpose. And that's what Hitler was doing, what the Nazis were doing to some extent, is they were going through the travail of the modern world to try to save some of this denigration, this destruction.
Right.
Anyway, it's a very interesting system, if you can find his books.
They're difficult to get a hold of?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. They talk about how the... when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I couldn't find any of this stuff for years. And about last year and the year before, suddenly they became available in English. And I have most of his main books. Mostly he's got one called Hitler, the Ultimate Avatar, which is the one of a trilogy of books that he wrote, of course, in Spanish. And which became available in English. And then I was looking around on the internet, as a matter of fact, about last week to see, and they seemed to become unavailable again. So I have a copy, but you know, it's a very interesting full blown system. It's obviously not something people want to become popular, but it includes a lot more than Nazism. Also, he goes back into, and it's a prehistorical system. It goes back to the origins of mankind. So it's all very complete. But, you know, if that came from his own experience, he's a very poetic writer. You can easily get some of his books. You can probably get Nos, Book of the Resurrection, N-O-S, Book of the Resurrection, has been widely available in English. His book, his meetings with Jung and Hesse is very available, but you don't get a sense of his cosmological system out of there.
There are many aspects to what these people were teaching that is interesting that we should discuss more later. Kind of the bigger philosophical question that pertains to both what this period that we've just gone through really was about, the World War II, this immense pinnacle really in modern history, and obviously we're living in the times, the consequences really of this period, and yet these people who preceded all of this kind of, I think they come to us with a kind of a work that we have a connection to in one way or another, whether we like it or not. But so that's something I want to try to tackle in the next segment. One thing I want to kind of cover here before we take a break is basically your take on why some of this work is important to us today, right? Because, I mean, these are occultists, they're esotericists. Some people just by mentioning those names would throw that out right away. Obviously, for Christians, this might be difficult, etc. But this is a difficult question. But what do you think of this work? Why is this stuff important to us today? What are some of the layers of truth to you in this material?
Well, I mean, I think there are issues about why it's important to me, and it may not be important to everybody. I think that every society certainly has people who have these interests. You know, if you look at this division of humanity into workers and clerks and to priests and soldiers and all this sort of thing, only certain people are going to care about the philosophical and spiritual underpinnings. And as I said, most of the spirituality can be cooked down into a religious format and used to motivate large groups of people. For those of us who want to know why, who want to understand things down to the bottom, it's essential to go down some sort of path that makes things make sense on the most fundamentally coherent level. These people can do that for some people. Certainly not for everybody. I mean, if we're talking about surviving as a people, as a race, as our nations, some people are aptly motivated by saving their families, by saving the people they know, their communities. This is certainly good. This is understandable. For some people, it's enough. You say, there are, you know, the people that founded my culture, for one thing, you know, we're looking at a world civilization that's built on things that were established by Indo-European culture.
That's right.
And there's no evidence that it can survive without them. There's a lot of evidence that it can't.
Yeah.
Look at whenever our civilizations have been turned over to third world civilizations. Look what's happened. Look at Africa. Look at Haiti. Look at most of South America. Look at Brazil today.
Yeah.
It's obvious that if you want to preserve world civilization, you need to preserve this culture and the people that can run it. And the interesting question comes from, you know, what can the Asians do? We don't know. It seems like they can carry it on to a certain extent. It doesn't go to hell like it does in some of these other places. But there's no idea that it gets created there. Basically, if you want to save world civilization, you need to save us, whether you're one of us or not. If you want to know why, then you have to go into these deeper philosophical situations. And, you know, and I'm not an enemy of Christianity per se. It's certainly better than a lot of the alternatives. But to me, I look at things as that at some point, you know, something came into Europe and started an infection that brought us where we are today. And I see a lot of that starting with Christianity. And I think if you want to get the purification down, ultimately, you have to go below that level and look at what was there before. But that's just me. And I really don't want to. I realize I'll be alienating Christians. And I certainly think that their spiritual truth is worth fighting for. And they certainly would be my allies in trying to preserve civilization.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
So I don't want to antagonize people. But I'm just saying, for people who don't find that satisfactory, I think this is an alternative.
Yeah, very interesting. There's a lot more here to obviously get into the meat of it or whatever, but and we're going to try to tackle some of that in the next segment here. Let's talk a bit about your website and some of the things you write about, Bob, and what your, I guess, if you have bigger plans for this. I mean, I know you're kind of, I guess you're still learning and researching, you're looking into all these things, but do you have any plans on writing something more official on this, or what's your plans?
If I had the time, I would love to. I mean, if you go to my website, I only started the current blog site last year, so about in December. It's kalkyvaisthor.net, if you put that spelling up for people at some point. I've only got maybe 20 feet. I'd actually slowed down on my writing because I was starting to get very political in my writing, and I realized I really wasn't contributing that much because everybody else is capable of doing that. So I just started to do a little bit more of spiritual exploration and trying to write about that. But I intend to get more active on it again. I just took a little break. And there's actually a previous blog site called the Ratzaz Diaries, R-A-T-Z-A-Z Diaries, which I actually wrote for 4 or 5, 6 years during the evolutionary period in which I went from being, a pretty much a liberal, a political liberal into a Buddhist student. And then over the course of the years between that, maybe 2008 or 2009, when I wrote the last one, watch me evolve into something closer to what I'm doing now. But it's a bunch of it. I cringe when I read it, but it's still there if anybody wants to.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, well, we go through these changes. You know, it's understandable. And the more you learn, the more you realize, the more truths you discover. I think it's good. I think because it's evidence of a genuine desire to know and a search. And to see, because we've in many regards gone through the same on the program. Maybe we were never liberals, but we're into new agey topics and, you know, very much occult things and spirituality and things like this. And it's kind of, you know, on par with what you're saying. We've transmuted and transformed as we've learned things, and we've come to realize the appreciation of our own culture, of our own people, as we also, of course, working against a huge, massive machine that basically is seeking to destroy the Caucasian people and wipe us out. And in that process, you kind of, you know, you activate some kind of survival mechanism, I would say, as you learn, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it might be helpful to some people to see that they're capable of going from being a Zen Buddhist. And, you know, I voted for Obama in 2008.
Oh, boy, really? Yeah.
I didn't think anything could be worse than George Bush, you know? I'm not sure it's too much different, to tell the truth.
Right.
But, in terms of doing anything else further, I would love to, you know, but I just don't have the time right now. So maybe in a few years I'll be able to not work anymore, you know, and we'll have time to do something like that. I intend to do so. I would love to, you know, all sorts of things I think I'm running out of time to do. I want to spend some more time. I would love to spend some more time in Europe, but, is Europe going to be there?
Yeah, before it goes down in flames. Yeah.
I've been studying German for 3 or 4 years. Am I studying something that's going to become one of the next dead languages? I don't know.
Jesus. Oh, it's worrying. It's damn worrying, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Much more of this coming up here then, folks. But the meantime, the website, let me spell this out for you guys who are not, you know, you might be listening in different ways and want to check it out later. So it's Kalki, that's K-A-L-K-I, that is Weisthor, W-E-I-S-T-H-O-R.net, KalkiWeisthor.net. So definitely check out the website. Much more of this interesting stuff is coming up. Stay with us, Bob. We'll be right back after this. Well, stay tuned. The second hour is coming up. We have much more to discuss with Bob or Kalki on the esoteric traditions of pre-Christian Germanic spirituality. He mentions that we are in an occult war, and we discuss who the belligerents in this war is. We talk about some of the lore around the Hyperborean / Aryan race, you know, this idea of the root races that came to us from some of Blavatsky's work and some of these ideas. We also discuss some hypotheticals and discuss what would happen if we cannot awaken the spiritual side. We also discuss so-called esoteric Hitlerism and get into what Der Führer represented from a more, bigger Yuga cycle perspective. Some have said that this act of losing the war was actually an expression of him as an avatar from a spiritual perspective. This is some of Savitra Devi's work, and we'll talk more about that to try to understand what some of the points in that is. It's a pretty interesting angle for sure, so definitely don't miss it. If you want to hear the rest, go to redicemembers.com if you're not already a member and acquire a membership with us. It's only €6 per month. You can try it out for a 3-month subscription, and you get full access to all our shows, live TV shows, videos, films, and much more. Upcoming on the show, we have Ricardo Duchesne, then we have Alfred and Monica Schaefer, and much more coming on after that. Also, of course, don't miss our Weekend Warrior show on Saturday the 3rd. We'll start up at 5 p.m. Eastern. That's 11 p.m. Central European Time. Don't miss it. More at redicemembers.com. redice.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.